Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. The killing of George Floyd at the hands of a white police officer last week is difficult to watch, but for Black Americans especially, these incidents of violence can be mentally and emotionally exhausting, heartbreaking, and traumatic. It's also renewed calls that racism should be treated as a public health crisis. This week, the city of Cleveland in Ohio actually voted to do just that. Here to talk more about this is Helen Neville, a professor of educational psychology and African American studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She researches racism, racial identity, and diversity issues related to well-being. She's also the current president-elect of the Society for the Psychological Study of Culture, Ethnicity, and Race, which is a division of the American Psychological Association. Professor Neville, welcome back to the 21st. And we seem to be having some technical issues connecting with Professor Neville.
Thank you so much.
You are here. Oh, great.
I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you so much.
That's all right. It happens. Thank you for being here. And I just want to remind our listeners that you can always join the conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That number again is 800-222-9455. Well, and I should add, we are connecting on Zoom, so sometimes we do have these little digital hiccups. So, Professor Neville, thanks again for being here. And I want to begin by asking you about Cleveland. The city recently voted to declare racism a public health crisis. Do you think racism is a public health crisis?
Thanks a lot for inviting me back to come and talk about this incredibly important topic. And painful topic. And to answer your question, yes, I do believe that racism is a public health crisis. It has been for a long time. And it's not only a public health crisis, but it's an economic crisis. It's a whole range of things. And I'm sure that people probably are asking themselves, well, what does it mean to be a public health crisis? I mean, that's what I would be asking myself. And why would some folks be compelled to pass a resolution that talks about it as a public health crisis? And I'm happy to go into talking about my understanding about racism as a public health crisis, if you think that would be helpful to the listeners.
Absolutely. Yeah. Please do.
Some of the things is, I think, unfortunately, in our society, when we think about racism, people want to reduce racism to individual level prejudice, where somebody holds negative feelings or beliefs about somebody else. And that's just prejudice. That's not racism. Racism is really this racial prejudice, which is rooted in white supremacy and actual power to create disparate outcomes based on those belief systems. So it's important to understand that racism is not just an individual act, but it's part of these larger structural institutions.
And if I can just pause to ask you, because this is such an important point. And later in the show, we're hoping to bring our listeners a conversation with an author who's written about white fatigue and this related idea of white fragility that's out there. And I think that I just want to drill down on what you're talking about, because I think that for many people, and I'll say this myself included, you know, we grew up with the idea that racism is something that's mean people do, or, you know, Bull Connor doing that sort of thing. And if we're not doing that, the idea, you know, it's abhorrent to people that then they're called part of a racist structure. And I'm glad you're sort of explaining this difference. And can you talk a little bit particularly about what you mean by white supremacy, right? We're not talking about skinheads here when you use that phrase.
Okay, great. That's a great idea. So there's a lot of what you've said that I would really like to unpack.
Sure.
But white supremacy is not just the belief and the ideology that white people are superior, but it's also in terms of their belief that Black and other people of color, indigenous folks and other people of color are inferior, that our cultural productions, that who we are inferior to whites. And therefore, whites deserve to be more advantages. And so what does that look like in our society? It looks like who gets our language. Folks who speak African vernacular English are thought as that English is less than, not as intelligent. It's looked at in terms of our family structures, how we work, how we talk, how we interact, that it's the white way of doing things is the right way of doing things. And then that sets up a whole cascade of other institutional practices and policies that unfairly discriminate against Black folks, Indigenous folks, and other people of color that really get to this public racism as a public health crisis. What are those? Those would, the way that it looks right now in COVID-19, I'm sure people have been reading about the statistics. The New York Times recently ran an article a couple weeks ago, and in that article, it cites a research that talks about preliminary data where Black folks were 6 times less likely to get tested for COVID-19 and receive treatment for COVID-19 symptoms. It's this type of not understanding and being sympathetic to Black people's pain, to our symptoms, that lead to inequalities. And that's just one example of that. But racism then as a public health crisis is related to the fact that we are in jobs right now that are racially segregated and that we're paid consistently less. We are now entering what's gonna, you know, an economic crisis. And who's going to be hardest hit by that? It's going to be Black folks. It's not by our biology. It's by design. It's through racist and racialized practices. It's in our racial segregated housing. It's in our the criminal justice system. So the way that racism in our structure and racist institutions and structures promote inequality, in which white folks benefit and people of color do not. And that's really, really hard for people to understand, especially if they want to just say that I've worked hard and therefore I deserve everything I get. Well, people of color work hard too, and they deserve to have economic prosperity. They deserve good jobs, good education. So it's really hard. I spent 20 years looking at this construct of colorblind racism or racial ideology. And that's really what's at play here, is that people want to deny or minimize or distort the significance of this structural level racism that's created inequalities that are the reasons why that people are in the street now uprising. Their anger over the inequalities in which Mr. George Floyd represents, Miss Breonna Taylor, Mr. Ahmaud Arbery, and the list goes on. It's those deaths, but it's also the inequalities that Black people also are facing, this anti-Black racism. And when people don't see that, is what I'm calling, you know, when they deny that reality, they minimize it, that is colorblind racism. And folks who have higher levels of this colorblind racism, they don't think about race and racism, that they then have less empathy for people of color. They're less empathic to our pain. They're less, they're more able to tolerate our suffering. And so by naming racism as a public health crisis allows us to name structural racism, the what it's done to us contemporary, but historically, the pain that it's caused. And it also allows us to have conversations about what needs to be done and where we need to go from here.
If you're just joining us, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been speaking with Helen Neville, Professor of Educational Psychology and African American Studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And I want to ask you, so as we're talking about a public health crisis that racism is, this is also, it can be an individual mental health crisis for people as these images are played on the news again and again. Do you worry about how this affects, I mean, it's almost an obvious question, but I mean, how does this affect mental health? People, particularly for African-American people who are seeing these images, you know, play out on the media?
Thank you for asking that question. And it is a mental health crisis. I think there's not one Black person I have talked to that hasn't felt numb, nauseated, overwhelmed, fatigued, exhausted, unable to sleep, unable to concentrate. Not one. It is and taking all of our bandwidth to stay present at this time. And so it's this repeated exposure to racism. It's looking and being exposed to that video repeatedly and knowing other people are being exposed to that. That takes an incredible toll on us. I personally have not watched the video, the whole video of Mr. George Floyd and his murder. I have not watched that. I cannot see someone narrate their own death. But to see those images where they have that are everywhere, it's ubiquitous, where they have the knee on the officer has a knee on his neck, makes me cry every time I see that. And so sitting with that pain, where people are so callous that they could take our life the same way they would take the life of an animal, and dehumanize us in that way, it's hard not to connect with that. And what I'm seeing in the people that I talk to, it also then connects to anti-Black racism that they've experienced on their jobs, growing up, in their neighborhoods, in the stores. So it's triggering a whole host of trauma that has been accumulated over the years. And then there's also the intergenerational trauma that goes with this. So to know that our parents and our grandparents and their parents went through similar struggles, but they resisted those struggles, which gives us joy and hope. But it's very difficult and painful. Yes. It does play an incredible mental health toll on us at this moment.
And
It's a,
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
uh-huh.
I was
Yeah.
say
Go ahead.
it's
Yeah.
not a
Yes.
unique this is not a unique experience, right? I understand you've studied the emotional reactions of college students to the killing of Trayvon Martin, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. What we've done with that was to look at students and ask them how they felt hearing the verdict, or how they felt when they learned about the shooting, and how they felt after learning the verdict. And folks are folks who are were aware of racism, who understood the structural issues that are exist in society, were the ones who felt the deepest pain. These are the ones who are empaths. And so, of course, it's going to impact us. And so, there is data suggesting that these kinds of events are having an impact on us psychologically. There's also some really interesting work done by Brandeisha Tynes, who's at the University of Southern California. And she discussed and looked at these viral videos, much like the George Floyd video, but this was before the time. What impact do these viral videos that dehumanize Black folks and Latinx folks, what impact does it have on adolescents' psychological well-being? And she found that exposure to these videos are impacting adolescents' levels of depression and anxiety. So I think those it's important to keep that in mind as well.
And I wonder, there's this idea, and we're getting close to the to needing to take a break here, and I hope you can stick around with us after that. But this is a bigger question than we have time to answer. But I want to begin this idea of fatigue coming from people of color, right? You hear this frustration that these police killings keep happening, and even in workplaces, this idea that it's somehow up to people of color to make their offices more diverse, and it's up to them to make sure that diverse voices are heard in conversations. And I think you hear people are really tired of having to do this work. And like I said, we have to take a short break here, but just if we can kind of begin to dig into that idea to start that conversation in about a minute before our break. You know, how what do you think of that?
Yeah, thanks a lot for asking that. And some people will call that racial battle fatigue. That explains all that of exhaustion. I think it is important that people realize, one, that the Black colleagues are already in the moment experiencing this. It is not their responsibility to chart out, to take care of white folks and their guilt, to chart out a response, to help folks figure out how to move forward. That adds an added burden when people are already taxed. My recommendation is to encourage these units and employments to provide space for their Black colleagues to process the pain, for them to acknowledge the pain that people are going through, to connect with them as human beings, and then to pull together as white folks to then begin to say, what work do we need to do to begin to address this? Do we need a statement? What resources do we have or can we gain so that we can address this? So the onus of responsibility is not just on one or two people to address the pain that they're experiencing.
Okay, we're speaking with Professor Helen Neville. I hope you can stick around with us after the break. We'll continue this conversation. Please join our conversation, 800-222-9455. You're listening to The 21st. More to come in just a moment. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been speaking about the idea of racial trauma and the idea of racism as a public health crisis in the wake of the killing of George Floyd at the hands of a white police officer last week. We're speaking with Helen Neville, a professor of educational psychology and African American studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She researches racism, racial identity, and diversity issues related to well-being. She's also the current president-elect of the Society for the Psychological Study of Culture, Ethnicity, and Race, which is a division of the American Psychological Association. And a reminder that you can join our conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. And we have a caller on the line from Tallulah, Illinois. Good morning. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning.
Go ahead. What's your question or comment?
Well, I listening to this conversation, and I'm hearing things I've heard many times before, like the catchphrase institutional and systemic racism.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I have a fairly good idea of what that means, but I know for white people not living in the same environment that Black people have to, it's very difficult for most white people to understand what that means. And if we could talk more about examples of the institutional and the systemic racism.
Okay.
What
thank
that
you.
Actually means, what those words mean.
Okay. Thank you for calling in. Professor Neville, I wonder if you can respond to that.
Sure. I'm happy to take a look at that. I'll respond to that. The way it practically means is, let's give some examples. We know that African Americans are overrepresented in the jails and prisons here. We know that they are arrested they might have arrest rates, similar rates in terms of drug uses, but they're convicted at higher rates. They get, and also at conviction, they get steeper sentences. We know that Black folks say are dying of COVID-19 at disproportionate higher rates. We know that Black children are being suspended from school at higher rates. We know that no matter what decade we're in, Black folks on average will have unemployment rates twice that of white folks. And that would be whether you have Blacks with PhDs or Blacks with BAs, whatever the unemployment rate is for Blacks with PhDs, of people with PhDs, Blacks will have twice the unemployment rate that whites with PhDs. That in terms of income, that Black folks, in terms of income, with a bachelor's degree on average, are making something similar to what white folks are making with a high school diploma. So we know in terms of home ownership that we have lower home ownership. We know that there's lower wealth. So the question then becomes, like, why does that exist? Why does that happen? How do you understand and how do you explain that? Since we know that race is primarily a social construction, it's not biological. So it's not something that Black people are doing to themselves. It's not that they don't want their children to succeed. It's not that people want to be incarcerated. There's something at play here. It's not that people want to die of COVID-19. And what's at play are these larger, which are many times unseen, social and political forces that create inequality through historic practices. I hope that makes sense. So, for example, mm-hmm. when we think about, let's just take housing, for instance. So, you know, Black folk, when the middle class was becoming middle class and owning homes, you know, through the GI Bill, they were able to get these great loans, move into these wonderful neighborhoods. Black GIs didn't have those same opportunities. And the loans were primarily going to white folks. So this is the creation of wealth, right? And so we were left out of that system. We have redlining, where banks literally wouldn't give us loans if we lived in certain neighborhoods. So there's all kinds of systems and practices that create inequality. And they're based on how individuals who run institutions think about Black folks. I'm hoping that provides some clarity.
Yeah, definitely. And a reminder that this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Professor Helen Neville, who is a professor of educational psychology and African-American studies at the University of Illinois. A reminder, you can always join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Before the break, I want to return to this idea we were talking about, battle fatigue among people of color. And I wonder what white people, and I almost feel bad asking the question, right? Like, but what white people can do to support Black people right now who might be feeling this battle mm-hmm. fatigue, or even just feeling overwhelmed by everything that's happening in these images we were talking about earlier?
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great question, and thank you for asking that. I think there's a couple of things that white folks can do, white allies. One might be not to ask for conversations or whatever, but to send a text to their friends and colleagues to say, I've been thinking about you. This is a difficult time. I just wanted to know that I care about you. Just to let them know that they care about. So that's one small thing, but I don't want them to just then drop that. There is some work that I think white allies and co-liberators can do. One is to begin to really do some deep, serious education about white racism, white supremacy, white fragility, and the way that that shows up in their own lives and in the lives of their communities. And so to begin to read work. Janet Helms has done some really good stuff. There's some other research done on white fragility there's some good TED Talks on white fragility to begin to unpack that. I also think it's important to begin to understand racism, structural racism, and Black folks' experiences. I would say, you know, looking into James Baldwin's work would be good. Ta-Nehisi Coates would be a good person to take a look at. And currently, there are a ton of webinars that are available. I want to point out one in particular. It is Intersectionality Matters. Kimberly Crenshaw with her African American Policy Forum has put together a series of webinars that are now also available as podcasts on the COVID-19 crisis and inequalities within that. She's interviewed guests from around the world that are experts in this area. And so people can kind of, so far she's had 10 or 11 episodes. This last episode happened yesterday, which she entitled Fire This Time, where they talked about the current crisis. And they also talked about the intersection between racism and gender, the fact that we're not speaking as much about, say, Breonna Taylor and working for her justice in that way. There's other folks that have also been women that have also been negatively impacted, so that we begin to understand their pain and humanize their stories. So I think white folks can also start to educate themselves and sensitize themselves around these particular issues. So one is to check in on their folks of color. Two is to start to do some intellectual work and to begin to unpack and educate themselves. And three, I really think to start to do some of the emotional work that comes along with that. For folks, it can range, you know, folks can feel angry. I'm not like that. My ancestors didn't do that. Why should I do, you know, and to start to unpack what that anger means. Others is to feel incredibly guilty. Part of the guilt has to do with, oh my goodness, this is going on. This is overwhelming. I don't know what to do with this. And they start to feel so overwhelmed that they shut down and not really address this. So I think this is a time to do some really deep emotional work to begin to confront the guilt, the anxiety, the concerns, but within their own groups, so that they're not overburdening their Black friends to try to take care of them. There's some really interesting work on that. I know Lisa Spanierman out of Arizona State University has done some really interesting work on the psychological costs of racism to whites. Not that she doesn't minimize that her work minimizes the pain and suffering for Black folks, Indigenous folks, and other people of color, but just to show how white folks are negatively impacted by racism. It has this psychological toll, but then it also creates, you know, problems that they don't have true intimate friendships with people of color. And I think we're wonderful folks to get to know. And so she starts to unpack that. And part of what she's getting at too is this idea of guilt. And what she has this interesting article that deals with white women tears and white men fears. So this idea that the way that guilt gets expressed among some white women, not all, but some, is through tears because it's so painful and guilty. I mean, it's so painful for folks, so they cry. But it's important you can lean into that crying, but not then to center your own pain at the expense of the pain of other people. That you yourself deal with the pain, but don't put the attention that your pain is the most important because other people are really suffering now. And then the fourth thing to do so after dealing with the emotional stuff, dealing that within community, is to begin to find ways to be in service of community, to adopt anti-racist practices, and to support the work of folks on the ground doing work. So people don't need to be the leaders of this, but they can actually support the work through, if it's the financial things, such as giving to organizations that they believe in, whether it's the Bell Bond Project, or whether it's Black Futures Lab, or whether it's your local organization. I mean, begin to really think about what are your values and how do you want to practice anti-racism in your action? But you can't skip to the action piece. You can't go all the way to action, let me donate some money or let me show up, if you haven't done some of this intellectual and emotional work, because what will happen is you might then further create harm with the people that you wanted to be in community with through various forms of microaggressions.
Mm. And that, I mean, that's, and we have about 4 minutes left in our conversation, and then we're actually going to be talking to a bookseller from the Chicago area about sort of a recommended reading list to start to do some of this intellectual work that you're talking about. And I should remind people, if you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. We're speaking with Professor Helen Neville, Professor of Educational Psychology and African American Studies at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. You can always join our conversation, 800-222-9455. And just the few minutes we have remaining, I want to ask you about something we noticed on your Twitter account. And this is the idea of allies. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what we see now from sort of the corporate, you know, the business world out there in terms of, you know, everybody is putting out their statements and trying to calibrate, you know, how they want to get on this. Can you talk about, you know, some of the things you've seen? I know the Paw Patrol, which is, if people don't have young kids, this is a cartoon show about this team of search and rescue dogs. They said they were muted in listening on their social media account and were pretty widely mocked for that. Maybe you can talk about an example of this the right way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. I think one of the issues, I think folks now are saying some of the statements are hollow and template. I think people view the statements that are most impactful is if, one, they name what the issue is. I know Ben and Jerry's named the issue as being white supremacy. So name it in terms of white supremacy, anti-Black racism, institutional racism, whatever that it might be. I think the first is to name it. Then the second is to acknowledge the way in which these have impacted of the development of our country and resulted in some of the current uprising. Third is to acknowledge the pain and suffering that this has caused. Fourth, then to identify that the company is not only in solidarity, but they are also taking direct action to begin to address these concerns. And these direct action could entail reflection on the policies of the particular association organization to see if there are ways that they inadvertently are discriminated against folks, mm-hmm. to increase the diversity of their organization, to begin to look at look at whiteness and what that means, and begin to interrogate that, and to take actions to promote equity within their specific institution and, you know, nationally.
Okay. Professor Helen Neville is a professor of educational psychology and African American studies at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, where she researches racism, racial identity, and diversity issues related to well-being. Professor Neville, this has been so enlightening. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And just a programming note, I did just say a few moments ago we were going to bringing you a segment with a bookseller, sort of a recommended reading list for people who want to learn more about racism and race in America. And unfortunately, we've just learned that our guest is not going to be able to join us today. We will bring you that conversation. We hope to bring you that conversation next week. So stay tuned. This is the 21st. We're instead going to be going with an encore segment. I'm Brian Mackey. More to come in just a moment.